Continuing in Revelation chapter 19, this is the marriage supper of the Lamb, verses 6 through the end of the chapter. And then I heard what seemed to be the voice of a great multitude, like the roar of many waters, and like the sound of mighty peals of thunder, crying out, "Hallelujah, for the Lord our God the Almighty reigns. Let us rejoice and exult and give Him the glory, for the marriage of the Lamb has come, and His bride has made herself ready. It was granted her to clothe herself with fine linen, bright and pure, for the fine linen is the righteous deeds of the saints." And the angel said to me, "Write this, blessed are those who are invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb." And he said to me, "These are the true words of God." Then I fell down at his feet to worship him, but he said to me, "You must not do that. I am a fellow servant with you and your brothers who hold the testimony of Jesus. Worship God. For the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy." And then I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse. The one sitting on it is called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and makes war. His eyes are like a flame of fire, and on his head are made diadems, and he has a name written that no one knows but himself. He is clothed in a robe dipped in blood, and the name by which he is called is the Word of God. And the armies of heaven, arrayed in fine linen, white and pure, were following him on white horses. From his mouth comes a sharp sword with which to strike down the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron. He will tread the winepress of the fury of the wrath of God the Almighty. On his robe and on his thigh he has a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Then I saw an angel standing in the sun, and with a loud voice he called to all the birds that fly directly overhead, "Come, gather for the great supper of God, to eat the flesh of kings, the flesh of captains, the flesh of mighty men, the flesh of horses and their riders, and the flesh of all men, both free and slave, both small and great." And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth with their armies gathered to make war against him who was sitting on the horse and against his army. And the beast was captured, and with it the false prophet, who in its presence had done the signs by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped its image. These two were thrown alive into the lake of fire that burns with sulfur, and the rest were slain by the sword that came from the mouth of him who was sitting on the horse, and all the birds were gorged with their flesh.
Good luck.
Uh-huh. Pretty pictures, but then in person.
First thing I think we can note is that the first and second beasts and all who follow them are destroyed in this scene. And in the next chapter we will see what happens to the dragon. Mm-hmm. It's a rather graphic and somewhat gruesome portrayal of what happens. There are two suppers mentioned. One is the marriage supper of the Lamb in verse 9. Then there's another supper in verse 17, the great supper of God. Are these two separate suppers, or are they one?
The gorging of the birds.
There are two parenthetical commentaries that John inserts, each beginning with "for the," and these are found in verses 8 and 10, "for the fine linen," and then "for the testimony of Jesus." And so perhaps John indicates some importance to what John is placing on those two things. So where do we go from here?
I lost. What did you say, "for the"?
The phrase for the fine linen is the righteous deeds of the saints, and for the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy. Those are parenthetical statements. They are commentaries by John. John is explaining what he is seeing, or what he has been told. Mm-hmm. first thing we can note is this. In verse 6 it begins, "Then I heard." And then the second part of this set of passages, in verses 11 and 17, it reads, "Then I saw." This follows a pattern that we have seen earlier. In the very first chapter, John heard a voice like a trumpet, and then he saw one like a son of man. In chapter 7, John heard the phrase 144,000, and then he saw a great multitude. In both of those instances, what he heard and what he saw, he described differently, but they were describing the same thing. And we can carry that pattern over to chapter 19 also. What he hears is a description of the marriage supper of the Lamb. What he sees is also a description of a supper.
So you're saying the two suppers are the same.
The two suppers are probably the same.
Interesting.
I'm a vegetarian, thank you.
You're not into kings and beasts for supper?
So this is all basically like he's always hearing an explanation first before he sees the action.
That has been there's been a pattern of that.
Because for him to be able to hear the explanation first gives him a better understanding of the vision that he sees. Otherwise, if he was to see this vision, he might be a little bit overwhelming to not understand. But
it really plays into the drama.
I think a lot of interpreters of Revelation see this as two separate suppers.
Mm-hmm. And they don't seem to have much in common.
Yeah, and make interpretations and applications based on that assumption. Mm-hmm. What we're doing here is, okay, let's look back to what we have seen as patterns in Revelation. And this fits the pattern that what he hears and what he sees may be described very differently, but they are of the same thing.
Huh. Interesting.
Well, it's kind of like, it'd be kind of like saying to somebody that we rejoice in the food of the kill that we've made, and we all have a great feast and everything's wonderful, but if you were to go then and just show an animal being shot and butchered and put on a table for food, you'd be like, what? So in a way, it's the same rejoicing, but you just don't see it that way because you get less context maybe with the gruesome
details. In the first passage, yes, you see the rejoicing and the victory. And in the second passage, you see the defeat.
The gory detail, yeah.
Well, I may be wrong, but on your comment there, right? In their time, the gory detail of the butcher shop was to them everyday life.
Yeah.
Well, I just... But
what you're saying is true.
But it's the difference between...
I don't think they saw gory like we see.
It's the difference between the enemies being defeated and the rejoicing in the victory.
Oh, I see, yeah. I defeated you, and then a picture of them being slain.
Right, yeah. Right. Yay, we've won, we're going to have a feast. And then a picture of the enemy being killed.
But that's, Mark's right, that's been all the way through here. It's always been a double whammy on your senses. The visual, the audio, the visual. And it's always been, is this true that the audio, always precedes the visual?
The audio, then the visual?
Yeah, generally.
I think so.
In the narcissist,
you ever watch scary movies?
Well, that was the question. Is yeah. Now decide, is it, which way does it go?
Oh, man. It's always the audio before the visual. It is like...
The
creepy. Yeah.
The creepy music, and you don't know what you're about to see.
Right. It's always the...
In the movie.
It's always that. Yeah, they always wait until... And you know what? Actually, most of the time, the audio is still more profound and pronounced than the visual, too, because... They always throw the build up, and then they do the bang and the visual at the same time. So even when you close your eyes, you still jump because you still have the. Oh my goodness!
Guys, never watched TV, right?
I've seen every Beast Harry movie that's ever been created. I think my dad watched them incessantly when I was a kid.
So what John hears first is what appears to be a voice of a great multitude.
Mm-hmm. We've seen multitudes before.
We have. And this, the most direct allusion is to Daniel chapter 10, verses 5 and 6. Actually, verse 6, but we'll read 5 through 6, or we'll describe what Daniel writes in verses 5 and 6. What he sees is a vision of a man clothed in linen with a belt of fine gold, body like a barrel, face like lightning, eyes like flaming torches, arms and legs like burnished bronze, and sounds of his words are like the sound of a great multitude. And in this chapter 10, Daniel is being shown a vision where heavenly forces were contending and battling for his people. That's the allusion that John is bringing in. And John continues with his description of what he thinks he heard. It's like the roar of many waters and mighty peals of thunder. In Revelation chapter 1, Jesus was depicted wearing long robe, clothed with a long robe, a golden sash, described having eyes like flames, feet like burnished bronze, voice like the roar of many waters. In chapter 14, the 144,000 sing a song only they can learn, and their voices are like loud thunder. But they are also like harps, if you can, kind of a dichotomy there.
Thunderous harps.
And the 144,000, they follow after the Lamb wherever he goes. So the chapter 1 description of Jesus, where part of that language is now being brought forward into chapter 19, this description of Jesus echoes the description of the man in Daniel chapter 10. So when we take all of these things together, Jesus seems to be combining Jesus and the saints together as a unit who sings this next song that is recorded in chapter 19.
This follow after, that's a phrase. Didn't the nations of the world follow after the beast?
The nations of, yeah, they followed after the beast. This song contains the phrase, "The Almighty reigns." And this harkens back to chapter 11, where the seventh trumpet is sounded. And the seventh trumpet is really where the real judgment scene begins. And in this sounding, in this seventh trumpet, loud voices announce the arrival of Christ's reign. So, with the song of the saints, of the great multitude, singing "The Almighty reigns," what was announced in chapter 11 has now come. So the completion of the events of the seventh trumpet are being narrated in chapter 19. See, the narrative of chapter 11 of the seventh trumpet and the judgment was interrupted by the scene of the dragon, the beasts, and Babylon. This narrative of the judgment being handed down is about to resume with the war that comes. In chapter 7, not chapter, in verse 7, we see this phrase, the marriage of the Lamb, which is completely unexpected because this marriage metaphor has never before appeared in Revelation. But it's a common Christian theme because the Gospels mention the metaphor of the marriage as something that Jesus and the church have. So maybe it's new to Revelation, but it would certainly not be new to the thoughts of either John or his audience.
Well, okay. So if the 144,000 follow after the Lamb, and then the 144,000 marry the Lamb? In other words, the followers get married to the Lamb. Does the nations of the world who follow after the beast ever get married?
Well, they are in an adulterous relationship with Babylon.
And that before that can be consummated into a formal marriage, it's all destroyed. It destroys itself.
So that's another parallel between the two sections. We have the marriage and...
So before the marriage, the multitude are betrothed to the Lamb, but on the other side, there's been an adulterous relationship all along.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then the Lamb's bride is introduced. It's a new character. Now, it's the fourth woman that's mentioned in Revelation. The first woman is Jezebel. The second woman is the woman clothed with the sun of Revelation 12. The third woman is the great prostitute or Babylon. They're one and the same. And now this fourth woman is the bride. And we will see that this bride is going to be identified as New Jerusalem.
So the second woman is the woman that got cast into, or that escaped
that
from the
womb.
Yes.
And that was the first introduction of the woman being the church.
Yes.
So she's actually the same character as the new bride then.
Yeah.
Essentially. Not in introduction, but in
mm-hmm. Because the first and third share identities. Both Jezebel and Babylon, they share similar characteristics. And essentially, they are the same. Similarly, the second and fourth, the woman of Revelation 12 and this bride that's now introduced, is the church.
So this is, not only is this a drama, but it's also a love story.
Because, I suppose.
Because the tragedy is that the woman is... There was a relationship. It got broken up. Protagonist came in to solidify the breakup and make sure that they could never be together. The couple was thrown apart and toiled away, and now there's this rejoicing of the defeat of the protagonist and the marriage of the
antagonist.
That's what I mean.
You missed your perfection. Wow. Good.
And here we are together again.
Yeah, so the bride is pictured as partner to what is true, to truth. Babylon was the partner to the counterfeit. And it is said that the bride has made herself ready, and it was granted her to clothe herself.
Yeah, this is, we're getting close to my questions.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it?
Say that again.
So this is where the church has to start.
The bride has made herself ready, and the bride it was granted her to clothe herself.
Interesting.
Does that sound like works or what?
It does sound like.
Yeah, what does that sound like? What does that mean?
To own the righteous robes, the robes of righteousness.
I think you get to choose.
In chapter 3, in the letter to the Laodicea, was they were advised to purchase white garments from Jesus so that they may clothe themselves. In chapter 6, the martyrs slain who were under the altar, they are given white robes.
But they're alive.
But, yeah, they're alive. It's metaphor. Not literal. In chapter 13 and chapter 14, there were a call for saints to endure and remain faithful. It was a call for saints to recognize the beast. There was a call for saints to keep the words of Revelation and remain faithful.
Well, it's just like, you think he's coming, you know, the bridegroom thing, the virgin that had to wait.
So, yeah, Jesus could provide, and he does provide the clothing, but he cannot put them on.
You have the bride. To pick it up and put it on.
The bride must choose to take the clothing and put it on. In other words, Jesus provides everything that is necessary.
But we have freedom of choice.
Yeah, but the bride must take action on it. And the action that the bride is called repeatedly throughout Revelation to take is to not succumb to the temptation of Babylon. To remain faithful to Jesus.
Well, trying to sew this back together, though. Faithful to Jesus, not to put on the Babylon?
Not to succumb to the temptations that are...
What are the temptations of Babylon? What we defined last couple of weeks was that was a political, not a political,
socio-economic system.
Well...
So we're not supposed to... We're supposed to take care of that system.
You got to get it... That's kind of like a whole separate thing, the systems. What you have to do is relate it to your life. What temptations in your life make you not want to do the things Christ would do? Get it down to the rubber on the road.
That is the other system. There's two systems we're talking about.
But there's worldly systems that are out there beyond.
And we're supposed to stay clean of them.
Mm-hmm. And clean of your own greed and wants.
Yeah, John is writing to the church as a whole. Now, individual members make up the church, but John's concern is with the church. How collectively the church relates to the world.
Followers of Christ. Called the church.
So we're on 6.
We're about verses 7 and 8. Yeah, so over the past few weeks we've been talking about how the world's way works in the world. It's the way to achieve comfort and security. And the church
control
is tempted. But what it leads to, it leads to control. It's based on force. It's based on coercion.
Yeah,
it leads to abuse. It leads to dehumanization.
And that's what we're supposed to stay away from, is the world's way of controlling people by coercion and having power over people.
Tolerance of diversity.
And it's a difficult thing. No, it's nearly impossible because both who we are and what we it surrounds us.
Well, I hate to say it. That system sounds nice, but as soon as I walk out the door, it doesn't work. You can't survive in this world in that concept.
And like we said before, as soon as the church tries to organize itself, it's so easy to say, well, those systems work so much better for organization than God's system that we've been using. And if we're going to grow and organize and
produce,
then we've got to make a set of rules and make sure everybody follows them.
Well, there's people that are more inclined to organization than others. And so, chief organizers, they want cookie cutters.
They're leaders and want to lead and have everybody follow and have everybody obey the rules and do it their way and all that. And that steps on God's desire for people to, every person
See,
to...
organization in and of itself
choice.
Is neutral. Laws and regulations are neutral. But what they do, it goes back to Paul. Sin takes a hold of those things.
So the question that was coming to my mind, is it type A personality, what Dolores was trying to describe?
Yeah.
Okay. Is it possible to have a Christian type A?
Is it possible?
It must be.
And that's what you're trying to say. It's not the type A that's wrong. Everything has its.
It's the type Bs that succumb to the convincingness of type A.
The motivations that are behind a lot of these organizing and things like that are not necessarily bad. But it's the means.
Do you think Moses was type A?
He may have been.
And we assume he was a good guy.
So this is really, this is what John is laying out here is kind of the perfect parameters of a marriage. And what he's saying is that he's trying to give us an opportunity to understand the foundations of a marriage. Because compromise is the only thing that should be the word. Marriage should be the word compromise, because there's no such thing as getting exactly what you want when you're married. There is no such thing as the complete,
the perfect soulmate that you will discover, and then everything will be
right.
Everything will be bliss for
right.
Because you
there's
have
no skipping in the babies holding hands forever in eternity.
This is where it's in church where you find out your bubble just got burst.
But what I'm saying is that the perfection.
You
or
didn't
the,
know your spouse wasn't perfect until this moment.
Well, I'm not gonna be. I'm not gonna falter from my thought here because it's getting taken wrong. I'm saying is that we as humans.
I was agreeing.
I know. What I'm saying is that we as humans have distorted marriage into what we want it to look like, so that we can control the outcome of the marriage the way we choose it to be done. Some for control, some for submissive, some for organization. But what it all boils down to is that if you are a type A personality, in a in the right mindset of marriage, you would be able to control what you can and to your best ability, but you would not expect the other partners to uphold your decision-making skills the way that you say they should be done. And so you've joined together with these people to do the best that you can do, so your attitude with them would not be, you have to be exactly like me. It would be, I love you, and I want you to be exactly you with me, which is extremely difficult.
So you're talking about a type A person in a marriage with a non-type A person, and that person can do the things that they do well without stepping on the other person.
Yeah.
What Mark is saying is so true. It's not about systems. It's not about type, personality types. They're all neutral. They can be. But what's really happened is interesting. We started this whole today with Pat Robertson. That has given this whole Christianity a bad rap.
Well, it's a caricature, but it's the caricature that is spread.
And that is the extreme of what Christianity has done negatively. That's not what we want.
So it's really hard because in a marriage, like just saying something could annoy your spouse, or you could be, you know, you could be making somebody feel uncomfortable, and it really doesn't matter. Because it's all of our own personal responsibility in the church to not be upset by each other. Which nobody's really free from that. I mean, nobody is really good at that, totally, like to not be...
We're human.
Yeah.
When somebody says something, you know, there's a reaction in your brain that either says, ouch, or... nice, or you know something. There's a, you know, when somebody says something or does something, there's a reaction in your head, and you have to monitor it so something doesn't come out of your mouth. And, you know, negatively. You need to learn how to be positive about responding.
Yeah.
Like, we shouldn't be laughing at what you're saying. I shouldn't be laughing at what you're saying.
Well, that, or you just don't get annoyed by it. Yeah.
Can the church let go of the need and the desire to control?
Which is another way of saying, can the church let go of making sure it's right?
Is it okay for people to be wrong? In their opinion.
Ray used the word compromise. I would insert another word alongside that, and that is tolerance. We need more tolerance and compromising.
Yeah, tolerance and compromise does not mean you accept everything. There's a difference.
Well, both those kind of mean you don't.
No, you cannot tolerate and you cannot compromise if you don't believe strongly in what you believe. But both compromise and tolerance is a choice to...
not make somebody else exactly like you are.
It's a
choice to love.
It's a choice to love. It's a choice to respect the other party.
To love and respect someone else the way they are.
In spite of the disagreement.
And it's also to hold fast to what you believe in.
Yeah.
So you have an aspect that you believe in, so you're tolerant to let them go away and do what they believe. But you will stay and do what you said you were going to.
But the tolerant that I wish there was another word, the tolerant I'm thinking we want to achieve is not the one I accept you being wrong. That's not the tolerant I want. I accept that I believe myself, and I believe you're sincere to yourself, and I may not understand it, but I can believe that you're...
You know what? You could actually know they're wrong. They're calling blue red or something like that. And it's still okay to be tolerant, even if you know they are
wrong. But there's two sides of that.
But I think what Jerry is saying is the kind of tolerance that accepts another person the way they are and accept them as appropriately themselves. Who they are is appropriately themselves, and they're not. I don't need to think that they're wrong and they're bad. But we're going to sit here and tolerate.
Under the pure philosophical definition of tolerance, part of it is tolerance or toleration is a process of coming to a common understanding, which means that I believe I'm right in what I believe, and I do believe you're wrong in what you believe, but I also believe that I may be wrong in what I believe to be right.
So,
I think I followed that.
Let me give you a...
And so by exploring our differences, perhaps I believe that we can come to a better understanding of what reality is.
So if, say, I don't believe there's a God, and I feel strongly that there isn't, and you believe there is a God, and you feel strongly there is a God. So, how do we come to common ground there?
I can accept your...
I hold strongly to my belief, but at the same time, loosely.
But see, the thing that everybody...
I hold strongly to it, but not tightly. In other words, I'm open to the idea that no, there may be evidence out there that shows that maybe what I'm holding on to is not right.
Well, see, the worst put down you can do to a put down to me is I don't believe in God, you believe in God, but I tolerate you because I know where you came from and I know your experiences and I know who your folks were and I know that's a put down. I'm excusing your ignorance is the type of tolerance that I think is wrong.
Everybody keeps bringing this back to the individual level, which is okay, but at the same regard, when you read the letters to the churches, he's not asking the churches to remember these things as an individual. He's asking the churches to remember these things so that they, as a church, do not become involved in the system that is trying to take over their righteousness at the time that they're doing these things. It's okay to, because what you're hoping for in the church is that these things are hopefully already happening, the levels of righteous judgment and the common understanding between the individuals in the church are already there and established and working, and they're working together. He's saying, do not let these roads and avenues become your means of developing your church further into the society that's around you. And we keep breaking it into this individual level, which is okay, but at the same time, the things that are being said, like God or no God, that's not something that you would be really discussing inside the halls of your church at that time. You would already be with, hopefully, comrades in that regard. So instead,
well, I didn't mean you. Okay, and we're talking about church.
Well, yeah, you're not talking. You're more worrying about things that individual people would be fighting against in their own individual hearts.
The reason, let me intercept one.
For your family.
That's a safe extremist. The one that we are talking about is within our church today. There is black and white on how did creation happen. That's a volatile question, and rather than getting black and white, I think we need. Is tolerance a good word on that? Compromise doesn't work, I don't think.
No,
there.
It's a tolerance.
Well, you
but
believe
creation
strongly, but
is
you
a big issue within Christianity today. And I think that rather than polarizing the camps,
open-mindedness,
we need to have... Mm-hmm. So that's the reason why it's
That makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, though, there's a lot more in this passage, because the first part is the marriage. The like we were saying before, the first part is the victory.
Yeah.
Okay, the celebration of victory.
Yeah,
the second part
passage is not about marriage.
The second part is a
symbolism.
The
yeah, it's an image.
Of the enemies being defeated. The first part is the celebration of the victory that has happened. So it's the same thing. So, there's a lot more to cover here.
The bride is her clothing that she clothes herself with is fine linen, bright and pure. This is in contrast to Babylon, who is clothed in also in fine linen, but also in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold, with jewels, and with pearls.
Oh,
lots of stuff. In this image, the bride has a simple beauty. She doesn't need all of the other things to try to convince people looking at her of her beauty. Babylon has a forced appearance of beauty based on wealth and luxury. That said, this is not a proof text that women should not wear jewelry. It's a metaphor that the beauty of the saints, the beauty of the church, the beauty of New Jerusalem is not found in the stuff that she has acquired. It's inherent in her.
That's not what makes her beautiful. Babylon tries to become beautiful by putting things on. The church is beautiful, period.
Because of what Jesus has given her.
This, I think, is a tangent that probably isn't there, but jewels and all this stuff is a product of merchants and trading. It's not saying that we can have a world system without merchants of trade and commerce.
No.
That's a tangent.
So what is this fine linen? This is John's commentary. Fine linen is the righteous deeds of the saints. So again, it kind of feels like it's coming back to lots of works.
Good, I told you so.
First of all, in Exodus and Leviticus, fine linen is part of the priestly attire. What John is describing about the saints is the saints function as priests. The part of the function of the church is to perform as priests. And before we go continue on discussing this, just the word righteous deeds, actually the deeds is a interpreter's addition. What's only present there is fine, is righteous.
Okay, fine linen is the righteousness of the
saints. Dikaioma, and this is same word is used in chapter 15 verse 4 where it talks about God's righteous actions. Again, the word actions is an addition by the translator.
So it's not so much righteous actions or righteous deeds, it's righteousness.
It's God's righteousness or God's justice.
Mm-hmm.
And you can say fine linen is the justice of the saints. So, what are these deeds?
Well, they don't exist.
Nor are the goats and the lamb. That's kind of what they're saying, the metaphor. She's just reiterating that metaphor with the bride's linens and the and Babylon's linens. It just keeps portraying that aspect of did you or don't you understand why you're doing it, or just, anything. It's not just gold and silver is your actions itself. Do you feel that when you come into the presence of people that you have to show them that you've been a nice person, that you've done all these good things, that they see you for this great actions and what you are?
I think it's the actions are any time you prefer somebody else over yourself. Comfort, their happiness,
their... The exhortation that Revelation has given to the saints, the church, is to endure, to be faithful, to keep the words or the commands of Revelation, to come out of Babylon. In any religion, what's the function of a priest?
Intercessor.
Function of a priest is to mediate God. And this word mediate is to represent God. And it's not to appease God necessarily, but to represent God to the people. So whatever these righteous deeds or just deeds or justice judgments that the saints are being called to exhibit has to do with representing God. They are to serve in a priestly function representing God in the world.
Well, maybe I'm missing something, but you said the deeds was
interpretation of the word righteous.
So we're talking about righteous deeds of the saints, and we talked about, did we say something about righteous deeds of God?
Righteous actions of God.
Righteous actions of God. Is God righteous because of his actions, or is God righteous because he's righteous?
God is righteous and he does actions.
Because he's
righteous.
His
actions are righteous because he is righteous.
So, by putting that word actions in there and deeds in there, we're actually changing righteous as an adjective of what you do. But what you're saying is the original interpretation is it wasn't an adjective, it was a attribute of God. God is righteous.
And his people are righteous.
And because he and they are righteous,
then their deeds are righteous.
Yeah. Isn't that giving a different twist?
That makes sense. It does. It changes it.
And I think that's what you were saying. So the object is not, the objective is not actions. The objective is not deeds. The objective is to be righteous. By the way,
Hosea 15:4. Who will not fear, O Lord, and glorify your name? For you alone are holy. All nations will come and worship you, for your righteous acts have been revealed.
No,
so that's not...
Is acts in there or not?
No, acts is...
an interpretation.
So your righteousness has been revealed.
Well, and his righteousness has been revealed through actions. That's, actions are the way we can see that God
that's
is
how
righteous.
We think. But maybe there's a higher level that we don't think on. I mean, to the stupid English...
Well, you go back to verse 3, and it talks about great and amazing are your deeds.
In the English thought, the queen was a righteous person, if you want to use that word. And it had nothing to do with their deeds, just because they glorified their queen. We are trying to make everything into actions.
Acts would be a logical... It makes sense in the context here. When you go back to the previous verse, it talks about your deeds and your ways. Chapter 19, verse 8, where it talks about the fine linen is the righteous deeds of the saints, is a parallel to God's actions. Of 15:4.
Well, you got good recall. Very good. Thank you.
The point being, the saint, the church, is supposed to put on God's character. And the way the church is to function in the world is the way God would act toward the world. In that way, the church functions as a priest.
Representing God to the world. Okay. That makes sense.
Verse 9, blessed are those who are invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb. This is the fourth beatitude where it begins blessed. There are going to be three more, so there's going to be a total of seven beatitudes that are found in Revelation. The first beatitude was blessed is the one who reads, hears, and keeps what is written in Revelation, the words of this prophecy. Chapter 14, verse 13, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Chapter 16, verse 15, blessed is the one who stays awake and keeps his garment on. This idea of a marriage supper, again, is new in Revelation. Obviously, a marriage supper is part of the traditional wedding. And so, it's not totally unexpected, but it is a new concept here. This idea of a messianic banquet comes from Isaiah chapter 25, verse 6, where people are invited to a banquet. So who is invited? Well, we said that the church is the bride, so who's invited? The problem is, this is symbolic language, again. The bride is also the guest. Don't press the language too literally.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
You can be the bride and the guest.
When you think about it, the church is a whole, so it is one.
One body, we.
Yeah. These, and the angel says, these are the true words of God. This idea of true words of God, truth, is important in this passage. Allusions to the truth of God's word, or the truth of Jesus' words, the letter to Philadelphia and Laodicea in chapter 3, and also in chapter 6, 15, 16, and earlier in 19, Revelation noted that God's justice is true. So I think it's getting at, the emphasis on this true words, this truth, comes to the heart of what Revelation is describing. There's two systems, two ways. One is true, and one is a counterfeit.
Maybe I'm missing it, but if you're going to have a marriage, and the bride is the church, the church has been waffling, not understanding what is the true system, until it passes, I get it. And that's when you finally accept the marriage proposal. So it seemed like that's what's happening here, is the church or the people are finally saying, now we see God's true character.
Verse 10, John, this is John's description now of himself. Then I fell down at his feet to worship him, but he said to me, the angel said to me, you must not do that, worship God. This is an odd little passage, odd little verse, odd little commentary, because in Revelation up to this point, it was consistently describing God as the only true object of worship. So why would John suddenly begin to worship, fall down and worship the angel? there may be at least two reasons why John includes this. Jews have come to revere angels, and perhaps John is simply following his cultural norm and includes this as a polemic or a warning against angel worship. Or possibly a second reason, and not these aren't exclusive, they could be both. Could be a warning against elevating and worshiping messages and messengers, which religions tend to do.
Doesn't this track with Daniel?
How?
Didn't he worship the messenger? Track him?
May have. Can't.
But you're saying that this is a warning against worshiping the message.
That makes sense too. And then right after it is the section about spirit of prophecy.
Yeah, it's so, well, it says, the angel says, you must not do that, for I am a fellow servant with you and your brothers hold to the testimony of Jesus. Worship God. And then John's commentary on testimony of Jesus. For the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy. Now, if we take it in isolation, it makes no sense. But this idea of testimony, and this word testimony is also the word witness, it's appeared over and over again already in Revelation. It showed up almost immediately at the beginning in verse 2. As John is one who bore witness to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus. In chapter 6, verse 9, martyrs under the altar were described as ones who were slain for the word of God and for their witness or their testimony they had borne. And in 12, verse 17, it read that the rest of the woman's offspring who keep the commandments or the word of God and hold or keep or bear the testimony of Jesus. This word, the phrase of Jesus, to get a little technical.
An argument, they had to split up.
this going reminder of this little technical discussion that we had. It can be what's called an objective genitive, where of Jesus means about Jesus, where Jesus is the object of the testimony, or it can be a subjective genitive from Jesus, where the testimony comes from Jesus. And we have consistently favored the subjective genitive to be the primary interpretation in Revelation. In other words, this is the testimony from Jesus. What is the testimony from Jesus? No, it's the spirit of prophecy. Well, what does that mean? Chapter 1, verse 3.
Because that was written long before there was Adventist.
Yeah, chapter 1, verse 3 basically says, this book, what is being revealed from Jesus right now, is the spirit of, the word of, words of prophecy. And looking forward, all the way to almost the very end, chapter 22, verse 7, blessed is the one who keeps the words of the prophecy of this book. That tracks very closely to what in chapter 12, verse 17, the rest of the woman's offspring who keep the commandments, who keep the words of God and hold the testimony, the prophecy that is being revealed by Jesus in this book.
So this verse shouldn't be used as a proof text for Ellen White being a prophet?
It is not a proof text. It is, in the context of Revelation, it is speaking about itself.
And even, is it referring to the commandment?
It's not referring to anything outside of Revelation.
But even the commandments means what's in
the
Revelation.
Commandments are the exhortations that are found in Revelation.
We take one word and we just can't see outside the box.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what's the definition? Okay. Testimony is word.
Testimony is witness.
Witness. Prophecy is?
Prophecy.
No.
Prophecy is
doesn't necessarily
a message mean, from God.
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily mean about the future, but just
God is giving a message.
So when you set up your church around the end times of the message of Revelation, then you're worshiping a message, you're not worshiping
mm-hmm.
you're worshiping yeah. the message, you're not worshiping God himself.
Mm-hmm.
You're setting up your whole base of faith around a message of you have to get ready for something, not
mm-hmm.
you are ready because you're with something.
Mm-hmm. Well, another tangent to that one is just can I worship deeds rather than the righteousness itself? If I start worshiping the deeds, then it's back to what Mary was saying.
You need to be doing the deeds of your righteous God.
For the testimony over the testimony of Jesus, for the word of Jesus,
for the witness from Jesus.
The witness from Jesus is the
Jesus came to show us the Father. He was the Father in a way. I mean, he said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father.
The witness from Jesus?
Yeah.
Is the prophecy, and prophecy is message from God, meaning this testimony from Jesus is a message from God. This book, Revelation, is a message from God. Okay. Does that make sense?
Just a second. Spirit of prophecy. Spirit. So you're saying the witness from Jesus is the message. I don't get it. Yeah.
Well, prophecy is a message from God. What is the spirit of prophecy again?
Yeah.
What is spirit of prophecy?
Spirit can mean essence.
The idea.
The essence of the message. This witness, this testimony from Jesus in this book is the essence of the message from God.
And I want to talk about myself. I am so locked into hearing this phrase say exactly this that it's like learning a new language. I need to know what this says in its language because I can't hear it.
Uh-huh.
Mark, say it 10 times.
It's John's commentary. First of all, that phrase is John's commentary. It's not from... It's not part of the vision. It's
not
John's
word
commentary.
By word. Uh-huh. Vision.
It's John's explanation of what he is writing about.
So when it says, for the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy, meaning the testimony...
The testimony of Jesus is what the angel said. Okay? That phrase is... So just in case his audience may not quite get what testimony of Jesus means, John is now explaining.
The angel refers to the testimony of Jesus.
He is explaining that the testimony of Jesus is
the essence,
the spirit, the breath, the essence
of the message from God.
Of prophecy, and prophecy is Revelation, the book of Revelation.
So, your brothers who hold to the witness of Jesus, worship God, for the witness of Jesus is the essence of this book.
Yeah.
Weird, huh?
For the Okay.
Is the essence of this book.
And are you just saying yes to placate me, or is that really what this says?
Well, that's what it says.
The witness of Jesus is the essence of this book. That's what this book's all about.
And the book is saying the world will fail and God will prevail. And put on the duds that fit, that you want to be. You can put on the whore clothes, or you can put on the engagement clothes. Ready. You can be ready to go to the altar, or you can be ready to
That's where the John's commentaries in verse 8, for the linen is the fine linen is the righteous deeds of the saints, and verse 10, for the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy. Those, I think, are the key pieces of this passage. But John is emphasizing those as the important parts of his vision, at least in this small section. John is saying, so this is, the church has a priestly function to fulfill in the world. And this is how, by holding to the words of this prophecy, you can do that.
It is very important to understand what that is.
So without overthinking this too hard, to get a really good answer out of all of it, it's not very, if you quit overthinking it, basically it's just being given the opportunity through Christ to view God and to become part of His church with Him. And that's been the rhetoric since before Paul, was that here we now have this opportunity to be with God, and let's take it. But we're so prone to giving a rule aside of what we've been given to make things what we want them to be, that all of the context is clouding us again from seeing what we have been given from the very start. If you just quit overthinking it, you get a really great message that speaks straight through to your heart if you want to. Sorry, I read the whole thing already. So I'm
okay, you can read it.
For someone who was raised Adventist, this particular passage here is...
I understand. It's just that when you read it,
it is the key proof text for
Adventist.
Ellen White.
Uh-huh. And I don't know who Ellen White is, but she sounds nuts to me.
She doesn't.
No. Telling me that I'm supposed to worship the message, if I'm listening to her correctly, I'm supposed to worship the message, fear for my life, and tell everybody else that they have no chance of getting where they need to go.
It's the people that did that.
What I have to do when I think of Ellen White is think God did call her. And, I believe God called her. She believed God called her. And if God called me to do something, how willing would I be, to do exactly, kind of a way out thing. But people use her way beyond what she wanted to be used.
People use her way beyond what she was meant to be.
She's used as a sledgehammer. She's used as, you know, I mean.
But the whole, the whole word of God is used that way, though.
Uh-huh.
It's not just Ellen G. White. It's not just Revelation.
Nothing that I write is even necessary if you would only study the Bible.
What
she writes inspires me toward the Bible, but you should never take what she says any more than you should take exactly word for word in the Bible what it says, because it disagrees with itself if you do word for word, you know.
And even in Mrs. White's own lifetime, people tried to use her, people tried to say that if she is a prophet, that if she has words from God, then everything she ever said is applicable in every situation. And she said, no, it's not. You're crazy.
They wanted to take all her excerpts of her stuff and make books, and she said no. She never wanted excerpts, but they did it anyway.
They used little bits of what she said and applied them to totally different things and said, well, if she's a prophet, it must work.
She didn't want to be a polyprophet.
Well, it's really right here, and it's plain and simple when you don't overthink what's being read to you.
It's really to the point.
It's so to the point that it's not even. I mean, it's easier to understand because Mark has made it easier to understand by helping me understand genres and understand the way that something's being written. It's much easier than just reading it. I'll give it that, and I'm not going to say that I got this all on my own, because I didn't. But because of what I don't have as a background, and being given this opportunity to read this with a better frame and reference to do so, it's getting to the point where it's just kind of hard.
Redundant?
It's
actually very hard to prepare for this because it's so redundant.
Exactly. Well, I can imagine for you, you've been saying the same thing since we started 2.5-3 years ago. You've been saying the same thing.
And well, wait, at the end of the first section, let's do the second section.
Yeah, so we finished what John heard.
Yeah.
Now we're going to go into what John saw,
which is a repetition of what he heard from a very different point of view.
So he sees a white horse, and in righteousness, the rider, he judges and makes war. This goes back to the first seal with a white horse who came out, conquering and to conquer. And this war imagery comes from the Old Testament, where the righteous judge goes off to make war. Basically, Jesus leads the war against the counterfeits, and making war against unrighteousness and injustice is a common Old Testament metaphor for judgment. So nothing terribly novel or new there. He's called faithful and true. Do you recall the words spoken to the churches are faithful and true? And in verse 19:9, we saw that the angel said, these are the true words of God. So the idea of faithfulness and truth is important. It keeps coming up over and over again. So, what John heard in the first part are words of Jesus, and those things are true. Now, what John sees in this second section is also about Jesus, and it too is true. 12, verse 12, eyes are like fire on his head, and many diadems or crowns. Now, this idea of eyes like fire goes back to Daniel chapter 10 that we referenced earlier. The rider on the white horse had one crown. The dragon had 7 diadems in chapter 12. So this description of Jesus goes all the way back to the very beginning of Revelation, where Jesus was pictured with eyes like fire, etc. Now what we see is this final scene of conquering, the true, now has many diadems. Apparently too many to count. Kind of hard to imagine how a person can be wearing so many crowns that can't be counted. But again, not to press the language too literally. The point is that his power, his authority, his glory is greater than that of the counterfeit. The dragon with the seven diadems.
Greater than comprehension.
He has a name that no one knows but himself. This is kind of a echo back to the letter to Pergamum, where it was said that the one who conquers will receive a stone with a name no one knows except the one who receives it.
You said to name somebody gives you power over them.
Right.
So if God's unnamed, there's nobody has power over him.
No one, right. No one can give him, no one has named him. No one knows his name. No one can invoke him.
That's been a part of mythology.
Mm-hmm.
The power of the name has been the part of mythology's deepest power since time began. If you can invoke a name, you will have power in that creature. Or if your name is taken from you, you now have no power as a creature.
But notice that in the letter to Pergamum, the one who conquers, the saints, the church, will receive a stone with a name no one knows, except for the one who receives it. The one who receives it, obviously, is the church. So the church, and way back when we were discussing this letter to Pergamum, we said that this name is not the name of the individual people or the saints, but rather it's the name of God. And so the church knows God's name. The church has authority to use God's power. And we also said that this stone is a ticket to a victory ball engraved with the name of the host. That was something that was given to conquering Roman armies. So this may kind of tie it into the marriage supper idea. A big ball, a party that's going to be held for the victors.
Yeah, see, like without understanding Ray's understanding of mythology, I would have never known any of that. But Ray understands mythology such that this is using phrases that would be understood by those people, and that makes sense.
We, like, way don't understand mythology.
It makes sense.
You'd be surprised how much of mythology is taken from these stories and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. I mean, we use the word ticket to the victory ball. Well, you take the word ticket to victory ball today, we understand what that means, but in other cultures, they may not know what a ticket even is. I don't know.
The description of this leader, Jesus, continues. He's wearing robe dipped in blood. This dipped can also be translated sprinkled with. And Isaiah 63 describes the one who treads the winepress in wrath is splattered with blood. Kind of sprinkled idea. So whose blood? It could be the lamb's own. You know, the lamb who was slain. So it could be that blood. It could be the saints, because obviously the saints have been martyred and their blood spilled.
Both represent the wound at any point to get the blood.
Or it could be the blood of those who oppose the lamb. And given that tread the winepress is going to appear in verse 15 in regards to those who oppose the lamb, the last seems to be the best option for this scene. Verse 13 continues, the name by which he is called is the Word of God. And this may or may not be a direct allusion to John chapter 1, verse 1, where it says Jesus is the Word of God, but the idea of the deity's being the logos, the creative force, the Word of God, is common mythology as well. And we have already seen in earlier portions of Revelation where the Word of God is used in conjunction with testimony. So this points to Jesus as the Lamb, conqueror, and judge. And saints are those who hold on to Jesus and what he has revealed, what he has witnessed about God.
Jesus has witnessed about God.
Well, Jesus, Revelation is Jesus's. Revelation is a witness from Jesus about God.
And we need to know about God so that we know what we are about and what we're doing.
The scene moves from the Lamb and the Conqueror to his followers now. The armies of heaven, arrayed in fine linen, white and pure, were following him on white horses. When we were discussing the 144,000 in chapter 7, we said that it resembles military stances of the Old Testament. So the 144,000 and the great multitude, the saints, are the army that follow after the Lamb. This, they're dressed in fine linen, white and pure. This echoes back to the description of the bride in fine linen. So they are also the bride.
The army, the guests, the bride.
And when we read about the 144,000, they followed the Lamb wherever he went. So that, you know, this just all ties in all of these different images together. They're synonymous. The army is not angels that follow after Jesus, but they are the saints. So, again, this is not a literal thing where...
A mass of people.
Yeah. Because, you know, not depending on a person's point of view on what happens after death, saints are not necessarily... All the saints are not necessarily up in heaven at this time. They're... Church is also on the earth, so it would be impossible for all of them to be following out.
Anywhere.
Yeah.
They're not all in the same place.
Physically.
There's living, dead.
Yeah.
Maybe some.
So it's a metaphor. It's a metaphor. We go back to the Lamb, Jesus, and a sharp sword from the mouth, and he rules with a rod of iron. At the very beginning of Revelation, we saw the description of Jesus as having a sharp two-edged sword coming out from his mouth. We discussed that as meaning not a physical sword that physically kills. We discussed that as words. And this metaphor of sword being words to be used as weapons can be traced back to the Old Testament, including passages like Isaiah 49 verse 2 and Hosea 6 verse 5. Also in Isaiah 11, chapter 11 verse 4, it reads, "With righteousness he shall judge the poor, he shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth." And this reference then of rod of iron is a reference to Jesus, who, power and authority. So weapons mentioned are not physical objects, but metaphors for words that come from God and Jesus, and consequently the destruction described could also be seen as metaphorical.
Meaning.
So all of this killing of the great men, the generals, etc., is not a literal physical battle where people physically
die. It doesn't
die.
Mean that Jesus and the saints go out and slay a bunch of kings.
Right. Now, that's an important distinction to be made, because most popular interpretations of Revelation of this passage take this to be a literal war that takes place.
Uh-huh. We're going to have 1,000 years of peace after that. I have to go back and ask a question because I got lost a little bit. Isn't Jesus walking the wine press?
Yes.
At that point, I would say, and then it says, armies of heaven arrayed. This is a battle between right and wrong in heaven, and Jesus is walking the wine press. Isn't the wine press the battle? It's the interaction between good and bad?
Yeah.
So Jesus is, it's not the 144,000 in the winepress, it's Jesus in the winepress.
Correct.
So the armies of heaven Are we observers or are we participants?
I think we're participants.
We're participants.
I think it's God that defeats, but I think he uses people. I think his people actually are in the battle between good and evil, and he uses us to defeat the evil in the world.
I hear you, but reading this, it seems like I don't know if I fully read that into it. Yes.
Okay.
Well, the idea of treading the winepress is a metaphor for judgment. So this war is not a literal war. It's about judgment. His name is inscribed, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. The Lamb is called in chapter 17, Lord of Lords and King of Kings, so it's just transposed.
Mm-hmm.
This is probably the name that no one knows.
But everybody knows it now.
But everyone knows it. The Lamb and the white horse rider are one and the same. It's Jesus. Then we come to the supper. This is the only other occurrence of supper, the word supper in Revelation.
And there's two of them in the same chapter.
There's two of them in the same chapter. In Ezekiel and Isaiah and Jeremiah, judgment is described as a feast where oppressors are the menu items. So the close proximity of this unique word that occurs only here in Revelation, it is difficult to dismiss that the two suppers are related. And again, John is not saying that the people are literally going to feast on other people, or birds are going to feast on dead people. John is borrowing Old Testament imagery to describe the judgment in terms that are familiar to his audience.
Yes. The birds gorging on the defeated enemies does make sense to be the victory supper at the marriage of covenant. That is really interesting.
And, I thought about, did the birds represent anything? Probably not. It's just what was used in the Old Testament.
Well,
there's a passage in the Old Testament talking about birds feeding on the corpses of defeated.
And after any battle, you're going to see birds doing that.
And again, this is not allegory. It is symbolic literature. And so we don't need to say, birds represent that. It's just part of the overall picture.
Or there will be literal birds. Which birds will they be?
Now, verse 18, so whose flesh? Flesh of kings, captains, mighty men, horses, their riders, all men, both free and slave, small and great. This echoes what was found in chapter 6 about kings of the earth, the great ones, generals, the rich and powerful, everyone, slave and free, hid themselves in caves and rocks to try to escape the judgment. So, chapter 19, this 19 verse 18 ties the judgment to those who try to escape it. Another thing that can be said is Revelation is not describing multiple wars, multiple judgment. It's a single thing. It's a single process of judgment that is continuing through history. So it's not about what's going to happen at the very end of time. It's not about what has already happened in the first century, but it's about an event that is ongoing.
The conflict between good and evil. And we are participants in the conflict between good and evil. Jesus is the one who does the judging and determines which is which, but his are instruments in defeating evil in all ages. And the birds eat this
world. Verse 19, the beast and the kings of the earth with their armies, so is the opposing army, is now being described, with their armies gathered to make war and against the rider on the white horse and his army. Recall back in chapter 13 where the first beast goes to make war against the saints, and its followers ask, who is like the beast and who can fight against it?
Answer.
Yeah. And it's also described that its followers, its army, is gathered from all tribes and nations. And when the bowl of wrath number 6 is poured in chapter 16, the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet call forth unclean spirits like frogs to gather kings of the earth to war against the saints at a place called Armageddon. So the battle and judgment that began to be described back in chapter 12 and 13 continued throughout is being concluded here now. It's the same war. It's the same judgment.
And we have victory. So where did the word Armageddon come from?
Got one up there in the place.
Armageddon, that is... Did you miss that one? must have missed that one.
I don't remember when it ended up.
It means the mountain. Har means mountain.
Uh-huh.
Harmageddon.
Oh, it's Har.
Yeah, there's a little.
And isn't there a
breathy kind of a pronunciation?
Harmageddon.
Yeah.
Isn't there a Mount Megiddo?
There is a plain of Megiddo.
A plain of Megiddo.
Where it was a crossroads where many battles were fought in the Old Testament.
Uh-huh.
The closest hill to the plain of Megiddo is Mount Carmel.
Carmel. So
Mount Carmel is where, if you recall, that's where the battle between the between Elijah, the prophet of God, and the prophets of Baal, under Jezebel, took place.
So Armageddon represents the battle between God and false gods.
Yeah.
Okay.
Between systems. Just curiosity, where is it today?
What country is it?
Gaza Strip?
No, it's
current country is it?
Carmel is towards the coast, so it would be. I would think it would be in Israel, but if not, it would be like Lebanon, Syria.
I thought it was in the Gaza Strip. Yeah. I thought that's where the big battle was right now. It's going like this all the time. Palestine and the Palestinians. Anyway, not here nor there.
Well, and because that is that's Armageddon as the battle of at the plain of Megiddo. If it was a physical war, what would obviously make sense would be the battle between Israel and the Arabs.
And a lot of people today take that to be...
Right, and so in order for that fulfillment, if it was a physical description of a war to take place in that location between Israel and the Arabs, the state of Israel would have to exist, and therefore the United States must do all it can to preserve the state of Israel.
And that's why the United States traditionally supports Israel in everything they do, no matter how they come.
So, yeah.
And that's to keep from having that great war?
No, it's so that the great war can happen as prophesied, according to that interpretation.
Right. Okay.
Because the great war cannot happen until everything is in place and Israel has to exist and they have to control Jerusalem and all that.
They have to get to their seven generations or whatever it is.
Something like that. And they have to rebuild the temple and reinstitute sacrifices at the temple. And all that has to be in place before the end of time can come. So we have to promote Israel's interests in every way at all costs. Here it says Mount Carmel is in northern Israel.
Yeah, it's by the Kishon River. It's real close to the coast, 1,700 feet. Wow, it's a huge one.
Like halfway between Acor and
right up here, right here. Door, D-O-R.
Door and Acor.
So, Gaza Strip, I think, is right in here.
Well, Gaza was like right there.
There you go, yeah. So it's quite a ways north. It's 120 miles north.
So, the beast and false prophet are captured. And this false prophet is the second beast. Because the description of the false prophet matches that of the second beast when the second beast is described in chapter 13. What's interesting is in this passage, there is no description of the battle. It just is assumed to happen. The battle is not the important thing. What's described is the aftermath. Babylon has fallen, and so now it has the two beasts. So now I have the two beasts. So the question that was asked, who is like the beast and who can fight against it, is answered. Up to this point, the beasts appeared invincible, but that too is now revealed as an illusion when the true warrior comes out to wage war. So just as Babylon seemed impressive, and how could it fall? It fell in a very short period of time. The beasts, who appeared to be invincible, now are captured, and they are thrown alive into the lake of fire. This is an image back to Daniel chapter 7, where the beast in Daniel 7 is destroyed and his body is thrown into the fire. Fire is frequently associated with judgment in Jewish literature as well as New Testament. That doesn't mean the judgment literally involves fire. The primary meaning is in how fire consumes and destroys with no way to recover what was burnt up. And the rest were slain by the sword that came from his mouth and flesh given to the birds. The rest means the nations, the kings of the earth, the great ones, everyone else. And the birds who were promised the flesh of the defeated are able to gorge themselves. This is the closing bookend for this section. The marriage supper has arrived. Chapter 20 will describe the judgment on the dragon. So, as we've noted throughout, Revelation is meant to be read from beginning to end. Injustice is done to the reading when passages are lifted out and interpreted outside of the full context of the book. Injustice is also done when primacy is given to interpretation coming from outside the book, where the book provides basis for sufficient interpretation. The war described here in this chapter is not a physical war, but a war of ideas, principles, and words. This section is mostly narrative and descriptive of what is to come, with little in the way of exhortation or lessons. The two important pieces may be the bits of John's expanded commentary on the fine linen and the testimony of Jesus. Both relate...
got him in trouble, too.
Both relate in that they describe how God's servants are to conduct themselves while waiting for God's justice to fully manifest in this world. And so, in this chapter, John ties up a great deal of earlier themes. But there are a couple that still remain. We've come to the marriage supper, but the wedding hasn't taken place yet. So that still has to come.
Is the Is the supper traditionally before the actual wedding?
I don't know.
Okay.
It's just...
There you go, the rehearsal.
The dragon must still be dealt with. The prime instigator, the primary antagonist is still out there.
Daniel, I dare ask you if we are ever going to study Daniel this way, but Daniel, if it was written in prophetic future or if it was written in prophetic past, what it does is it shows the progression of nations to the end of time.
Yeah.
And it is literal progression of nations. It's just a literal progression of nations. And it may or may not show that God is observing, but it's a political progression, not political, but it's a history of progression of nations. We've always joined it with Revelation, but Revelation is not that at all.
And said that Revelation also is a literal progression of events.
And it's not. It's a total different...
The genres are the same. They're both apocalyptic.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But Daniel said...
And Revelation, John borrows language and images from Daniel. But that doesn't mean that Daniel should be interpreted in light of Revelation.
But Daniel interprets himself. He says, here is what it means.
Yeah.
This means this.
So, just to refresh my mind in a short phrase, what did the recipients of Revelation take Revelation to be to them? They didn't take it to be in Daniel. Did they know about Daniel? Yeah.
Probably.
So they didn't take it to be a Daniel. They took it to be a revelation of Jesus, who's... It's a
revelation of the conflict between good and evil.
Yeah, totally outside of political realms. It's neutral.
It's a revelation from Jesus about how God is going to bring justice to the world.
The world systems versus God's system and how it's going to be reconciled. Now my horrible question is, why does it take so much interpretation? If we wait 100 years or 2,000 years and you take Lord of the Rings, which some people understand, I've never read it, so I can't say I don't understand it, but I've never read it.
If you take that 3,000 years from now...
Are someone going to make it into a book of religious...
Is someone going to say, here's what it means and here's how the events have played out and it is truth?
That's
so
scary.
What chapter of Revelation?
19.
Or what proof do we have that just because this book is a little bit non-definitive, Lord of the Rings 3,000 years from now is going to be open-ended? Have we made something out of something that doesn't exist?
It's entirely possible.
That's not a good answer. Do you see what I'm saying, though?
People have...
36 is the lesson we're on? What's the 36th, Revelation 36?
It's the 36th time we've studied this.
Yeah, chapter 19.
No, I know. I'm just asking what that was.
This is...
Lesson 36.
36th. Yeah, lesson.
Okay.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So for 36... Weeks we've been... That's fine. No, that's all I was asking.
So
that's a long study.
It's scary to me that we... Ray talks about in... What's your term in history of all this, these beasts and mythology? There's all this stuff in mythology. Have we just locked onto it as a Jewish mythology and made something that...
Apocalyptic writing, similar to Revelation, was common after the destruction of Jerusalem in year 70, because the Jews were trying to explain how this could be in light of God's promises for their nation and for them.
That came down from Moses.
Yeah.
And this is one of the explanations of how God is working out good in you.
So present-day Christianity is recognizing that they hold Moses dear just like Israel did, and that they need to... I mean, Christian... Some churches, I'm sure, more than others or whatever, Adventists don't, but really give a lot of money, and they have flyers coming in the mail that says, help Jerusalem, you know,
reestablish Israel. Mm-hmm.
They feel that that's very important.
It's very important. Part of the reason is Revelation. Another part is there are some unfulfilled prophecies in the Old Testament regarding Israel and the Jewish nation in Jerusalem. And if a community takes the position that there can be no conditional prophecy, mm-hmm. that all prophecies must be fulfilled
and
literally,
will be and have to be,
then the rise of Jerusalem, the restoration of Israel, the return of sacrifices, and all of that must happen.
That almost sounds like they don't recognize that Jesus came.
It's dispensational. Part of that is goes back to John Darby in the 18th century, was it? I think.
And, are the Jews still in the predispensation?
Yeah, in dispensational theology.
The Jews
wow,
are
scary to teach this book to anybody.
The Jews are still
in the back.
So the Jews are still pre-Jesus, and you need to get Jerusalem back and get all their prophecies fulfilled so that they can receive Jesus and become Christians. Interesting.
I didn't catch that.
So basically, the Jews are still in a pre-Jesus state. Mm-hmm. And you need to get Jerusalem back and fulfill all those prophecies that didn't get fulfilled about the glory of the Jews.
Instead of saying, you just missed the boat.
So that they can receive Jesus and become Christians.
The Christian message is only applicable for Gentiles. The Jewish message applies to the Jews. The Christian message is for the Gentiles.
Mm-hmm. But there's many that are still on that train, and they really think that Israel is going to rise, and then Jesus is going to come down and apostolize the world and make the world perfect for 1,000 years.
There's that. Yeah, that's one view. There's
lots of different interpretations.
There's half. 4, 5, 6 major millennial views.
Wow. Weird. Okay.
Adventists have their own.
Yeah, it's a little unique. It's similar to one or two others, but with a slightly different twist.
You can go to the extreme that some fanatic fundamentalist ideologies have gone toward Israel is that the nation of America is a satanic cult that's trying to keep Israel around and keep people away from the faith of God. People really believe that if we disregard Israel, we'll finally be able to come back to God because it's because there's people in this country that are really trying to keep us believing in Satan and having our false ways.
All right. I do see why you had to do this whole section in 1 week, though, because it all ties together, the two suppers and everything.
Yeah, I couldn't separate them.
Interesting. The victory, marriage, supper of the Lamb, and the gorging of the birds.